People of Note on Fine Music Radio is proudly brought to you each week at this time by Peter Turin Productions. You're listening to Fine Music Radio, and this is Rodney Trudgeon welcoming you to this week's edition of People of Note. And I hope you are as excited as a number of people to know that the Rocky Horror Show is coming back to the Theatre on the Bay after a splendid run in Johannesburg and a sold-out run in Cape Town in May. And so it's back, and it's pulling in the crowds yet again, and rightly so, because it's a marvelous production directed by Stephen Stead and starring Craig Urbani as Frank Inferter. And the narrator in the show, a role that's always intrigued me, actually, is being sung or spoken or acted by Natasha Sutherland, who is my guest this week. And talking about this return, Natasha, welcome.
Thank you so much. So lovely to be here.
Are you enjoying yourself in the Rocky Horror Show?
I am. It is a truly bonkers production to be part of.
Yes, it's
I don't know what word. I think is a good word to describe it, right?
I think you're right. And in fact, you, as the narrator, add a kind of element of sense to the whole thing.
I'm glad you think that. Well, she's supposed to.
Yes.
I mean, typically played by a man, the narrator, but, you know, now we're casting females. She's supposed to. And Stephen, the director, specifically said he wanted me to make her into sort of headmistress.
Oh, yes.
So
yes,
she's trying to make sense. She's sort of trying to corral the audience, lead the audience along this journey, this demonstration, looking at this very strange thing. But, I mean, if you look at her, I think she is anything other than sensible. Well, that's how it feels in my head, but I'm doing it anyway.
But in fact, you as the narrator are a sort of link, aren't you, between the sanity of the audience and the madness going on stage.
Yeah, she very much is, I think, a litmus test between the audience and, you know, the story and the cast and how it's going to go that night. And she is a conduit. She's there to tell the audience what they are about to see and link the two. So, you know, no pressure.
But the other thing, and we were talking this just before we came into the studio, Natasha, you said, and we know this, every night can be very different in a theatre, can't it? Depending on the audience, you get some audiences that are very receptive, some you have to try harder, some might scare you to death.
Yeah,
do you
yeah.
find that?
Yeah, very much so. I think she's, it's probably one of the most technical roles I've ever done. And I mean, you know, everything's technical, but I'm saying that because it's a bonkers show and everybody's having fun and it's great, you know, it's crazy and it's about encouraging people to let go and don't dream it, be it, and indulge in your shadow side. But the narrator, very much because she breaks fourth wall and she engages with audience every night, I am in process as an actress because I never know what I'm going to. In fact, the audience are my fellow actor.
Yes.
So yes, I never know what I'm going to get. And sometimes you can get newbies who have never seen Rocky before. Sometimes you get veterans. Sometimes you get a mixture of the both, which is always interesting to see, you know, who's going to dominate.
Yes.
And it's really trying to make space and allow them to you know, have their own relationship with the show. But at the same time, Stephen Stead, our director, definitely wants this narrator to allow them to indulge themselves, the audience, but never derail the story. He's quite a beautiful purist and wanting it to be story first.
Mm-hmm. And quite right, I think.
Yes.
Don't you agree?
Yeah.
And have you ever had instances where the audience has disrupted the show, behaved badly, or been rude, or incident?
I'm finding Cape Town audiences quite well behaved. Sometimes I don't know if I'm allowed to say this, I wish they could maybe be a little, you know,
a little wilder,
a little bit wilder. Sometimes we get lovely shout outs. I think there was one night where it got quite loud, and you can just feel the energy. So what I do is an intermission. I quickly have to recalibrate and always plot ahead, like if this happens, because there's certain pinpoints that I know in narrator's speech that something could go wrong, that I know that is a point to pull them back, or if it's a different crowd, that is a point where I can encourage them to go. So for me, I can't speak for any other narrator, but for me, that's how I engage every night. So it's like really keeps you on your toes every night.
When do you happen to know when the first woman was? Because Richard O'Brien, who wrote the whole thing, must have agreed to allow a woman, because famously that great actor Charles Grey played the narrator in the film rather grandly.
He did.
And so a woman up there is very, very different and adds quite a different dynamic to everything.
It does. I can't say internationally when the first one came, but I know for me, because I've seen many Rockies, seen Kate Normington.
Yes, that's you. She was the last one, yeah.
And I was so excited to see that, and not in a woo-woo feminist kind of way, also because I'm just a big fangirl of Kate Normington. I think she's amazing. But then again, it's also a director's choice. Are they going to make a female narrator very much that gender, or are they going to make it more sort of gender fluid and ambiguous?
Oh, that's a thought, yes.
So there's so many ways you can go. And so Stephen's vision for the narrator was very clearly strictly, you know, a woman, headmistress, you know, that kind of...
I like the headmistress thing.
Yes.
Because now that I think about it, you look like a headmistress on stage.
Yes. Well,
which I mean it as a compliment,
yeah,
by the way.
Well, I mean, thanks to, very much thanks to, you know, wardrobe and everything.
And just a quick question before we go to our first piece of music. What, when you were offered the role, did you grab it or did you have to be persuaded?
Oh my gosh, no. What's to... It's Rocky Horror. It's iconic. To be part of Rocky Horror, directed by Stephen Stead, to be working, you know, at Theatre on the Bay with Anton Dwayne, you know,
the Lantu boys.
It was just a no brainer. And I mean, don't get me wrong, I'm not saying easy peasy. It's terrifying to say yes when you know that so many greats have done a similar role. I mean, the narrator is a small but iconic role.
Absolutely.
In fact, the other night, I had someone afterwards in the foyer come up to me and go, you had very big shoes to fill, didn't you, from Adrian Galley? And I was like, oh. And they went, well done. You really did it very well. So,
well,
yeah.
Hear. Mm. Natasha Sutherland is my guest. What is your first piece of music, Natasha?
Oh, what have we got here? I see Take On Me. Aha, MTV Unplugged, the 2017 acoustic version.
Is there a reason for this choice?
Very much so. So a while ago, I was fortunate enough to be cast in a VR theatricals production of Shirley Valentine, directed by Gina Schmuckler. I don't know if anybody knows. Everybody goes straight to the movie, you know.
Yes,
but it actually was a stage play, one woman show,
right.
Before it became a movie. And Gina chose Take On Me as a sort of thematic song that's linked the whole way through. And this particular one is a beautiful acoustic version, and it's so clean and sad and haunting. And I just love it because I think I did about 80 performances across a year of that.
Yeah.
And I found the role so wonderful, and that it's just, even though it was written in the 80s, it's so resonant to so many people, obviously women nowadays, about getting to a certain time in their life when they've ticked all the boxes that life has expected of them, and then now they're in a space where they don't know who they are and they've
adrift,
left
almost.
Yeah, but on the other side of that is the chance to rediscover.
Yeah.
And so what I love about the song is that it's sort of pure and haunting at the same time.
Talking away, I don't know what I'm to say, I'll say it anyway. Today's another day to find you shying away. I'll be coming for your lover, okay? Say, I'm on sending. plans, but that's me, I'm stumbling away. Slowly learning that life is okay. Say after me, it's no better to be safe than sorry and take on. Coming for you anyway, and take on me, take me on. I'll be gone in a day or two.
That's the group A-ha, and that song was called Take On Me. Importantly, apparently, the acoustic version from 2017, specially asked for by my guest, Natasha Sutherland, who's with me here in our studio, People of Note. And Natasha is the narrator in Peter Tureen's production of The Rocky Horror Show, which has just returned from a standing ovation run in Johannesburg after a standing ovation run in Cape Town. So you best get your tickets quite soon, because it really is quite a show. What I wanted to ask you, Natasha, did you see the film of Rocky Horror when you were young?
I did. Recently, I did. I don't know how old I was. I don't know if I was old enough to, because it was banned originally.
It came out, then it was banned.
It was banned in South Africa, and then eventually they sort of went, okay, only for 21
year olds. That's right.
And then I remember watching, I don't know how I got to see it. I mean, my parents were in the industry, so maybe they were quite, you know, forward thinking. And I remember watching it, and it blew my mind.
Mm-hmm.
It was both disturbing and amazing.
There is something disturbing about it, isn't it? Especially if you're young, you think, what?
Yeah. But I think it was very postmodern, even in the way it was directed and put together. Mm-hmm. Like, we like feeling comfortable knowing that this is a genre we're watching. And I mean, Rocky Horror just doesn't make sense on paper.
But you also mentioned, just while we were chatting beforehand, about your mother being a very good storyteller, and that came into your first viewings of the film.
Yeah, that's right. So, I mean, my mom was a drama and English teacher and a storyteller of note. She was just amazing. I grew up on a healthy diet of mythology and Arthurian legends. And so she always had this way of telling us a story, and then she would deconstruct it, but not in a teachery obvious way. And I think that's why I'm fascinated with storytelling across the board as mm-hmm. a medium.
I
watched Rocky Horror, I think the little me was somewhere subconsciously or consciously, I don't know, trying to like understand the story.
This chaos.
And that's the weird thing is that I think it was about chaos, and Richard O'Brien was trying to open out so many conventions and preconceived small-minded ideas. And mm-hmm. and at the end of the day, I think as a little me watching it, the only thing I could do was just surrender. You know,
give myself over to absolute a famous line. Mm-hmm. And I mean, isn't that opening song sung usually by a usherette about Steve Reeves and Faye Ray?
Yes.
All those old films, horror, some science fiction that Richard brought in.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, that's just the one thing I think we were mentioning that Richard O'Brien had all these loves. Like, I think he loved, you know, rockabilly music, and he also had this deep love for 1950s sci-fi, you know, the B horror movies of the time. And he took all these different genres and pushed them together and created a musical. And so that he wrote that beautiful song with Usherette, who it was always originally sung by the same actress who played Magenta. Sometimes it's just been changed. That's why Stephen, in this run, Jasmine Minter plays Magenta, and he gets her to do the Usherette song as well. And it technically is not an easy song to sing.
Oh, of course, because really? It sounds so lovely and it sounds so flowing and easy.
Well, that's all credit to Jasmine Minter. She's just an amazing talent. But yeah, his lyrics are so beautiful because he's painting the picture of all these iconic 1950s horror movies that we've watched. And it's like, even though I am the narrator, I think the real narrator of Rocky Horror is the Usherette, because she tops and tails the show.
She does indeed,
and she basically says to the audience, I'm going to take you on this journey. Let's watch. And then she comes in at the end and go, I told you so.
That's right. That's a good way of looking at it, actually, the piece as a whole.
Yeah.
And is it a happy cast? It's quite a big cast, and they all have to be mad for 2 hours.
Yes, controlled chaos. Oh, my narrator thinks it's the most bonkers of them all. Well, no.
Not quite.
Yeah, it is a happy cast, and it's, you know, it's veteran actors,
yes.
We call ourselves, let's choose our words correctly. And then wonderful new young actors.
Yeah, all have come through LAMTA, as we've said.
Not all of them. A lot of them are LAMTA alumni. But what I am finding fascinating is watching this new generation of musical theatre actors coming up, and knowing that I think our industry is in very, very safe hands.
Yeah,
you know, when I started, it was like just learning on the trot, observing, and they come with so much knowledge and curiosity and respect and also confidence. So it's been very interesting to see. I love watching a creative process. So I'm like the one who sits in rehearsals. I love watching the interaction between, you know, director. And so yeah, I've been very impressed. And I would say we're a very happy cast. We have to be.
You have to be.
It's a long run.
Yes.
And it is a chaotic show. So you have to have your anchors in place, you know.
Yeah. And everyone's got to be on the same page at the same time to be mad like that in that show, don't
you
think?
Yeah. And then totally, also, like, you've got Craig O'Barney, who's just a legend in our industry.
Mm-hmm.
And he's the lead, and he owns the stage. He's effortless, you know, in his portrayal, and he never comes across as, you know, I'm the lead, I'm the diva.
Yeah.
We're all core. We're in some ensemble, and we
what a wonderful work
hard.
Way to work,
and
yeah.
Yeah, we all, in my mind, I think, are there to serve the story. We're there to serve the story and tell the story.
I want to ask you now about your background, but before we go into that, because there's so much you've done, Natasha, let's have another piece of music, and I see we're going to the ballet.
Yes. Yes, this is Prokofiev's Romeo and Juliet.
And why have you chosen this?
Oh, this is a beautiful memory. You know, I hope it is the right memory, because sometimes I wonder if I, you know, when we get older, we cross our memories sort of.
You really have to stop saying when we get older. Anyway.
So when I was younger, my dad and my mom were in this, I don't know if it was packed or NAPAC, I don't know, there was the ballet, and my dad was cast as Lord Capulet, and my mother was cast as the nurse. My dad, they were both into movement. My dad was a choreographer, and my
mom. I was just going to say who your dad was,
yes.
And that was Jeffrey Sutherland.
My dad was Jeffrey Sutherland, yes.
Indeed.
He was, I think, very much instrumental in a lot of musical theatre back
very
in his day
so.
In South
very
Africa.
Yeah.
And my mom was, as I said, a drama and English teacher, but she also studied movement. In fact, she got a bursary to go study at the Laban Centre in London, and that's where she met my dad, who was a lecturer. Anyway, little bit of exposition there, but they were in this ballet, and he was Lord Capulet, and my mom was the nurse, and I was a little girl watching this ballet, and I just remember finding the music so incredibly evocative. And I grew up with parents who listened to classical music. It was never foreign for me. And, you know, a wide range of music. And I just remember the scene where I think, you know, Juliet is getting married and the Capulets are so angry, but the nurse knew about it. And then Lord Capulet comes in and he's like really vicious with the nurse. And I saw but I know that that's my mom. Well, that's yes, my dad. Right.
Yeah.
So I'm understanding the story, but at the same time, the little me was going, you can't be doing that to my mom. So it was like just a very strong, I think Joseph Clarke was in it and Marianne de Wet might have been Juliet. I think it was that one. But I've just always, and whenever I hear this particular piece, it just takes me straight back to that memory and just a deep, deep love and respect and gratitude to my parents for exposing me to this beautiful world of storytelling.
that famous excerpt from the Romeo and Juliet ballet by Prokofiev, sometimes known as the Entry of the Guests or the Montagues and Capulets, but great music from a great ballet and the choice of my guest, Natasha Sutherland. And you're right, it's an extraordinary ballet that, isn't it? Since the days of Tchaikovsky, I think it's the finest that we have. We're talking about Rocky, the Rocky Horror Show, in which Natasha is the narrator. But you've spoken about your parents and the sort of background you come from. Was it a fait accompli that you were always going to go into theatre, or how did that get going?
No, not at all. I actually can't remember my parents ever pushing me. I do know that I studied dancing when I was little, which is ironic because I don't dance now. I did tap and ballet and modern, and I loved it. My dad was a beautiful dancer. But I think, unfortunately, when I became a teenager, my hormones hit, and I was like, you know, I stopped. I think one of my biggest mistakes was that I stopped dancing.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. But I have two sisters, and neither of them went into the industry. I just think I loved it. I loved the magic of the world. I mean, I remember the days of going to the State Theatre when the orchestras used to be in the orchestra pit and used to do warm-ups.
Mm.
And just that thrill of hearing the orchestra doing a warm-up and knowing it was about to start.
It's an incredibly, incredible moment when they tune and warm-up.
And my dad also, he designed sets and costumes, but the old-fashioned way. You know, he would build the sets.
Yes.
And I remember once watching him, and he was designing a costume, and he said, what color do you think we should make the sleeve? And I remember saying, green. And then I went to see the show, and the dancers had green sleeves, and I was like, I am so powerful.
That's all me.
But and like I said, my mom, just the way she told stories, and I think she was the one who helped me connect with the truth of a character. No matter what you're doing, whether it's something as heightened as Rocky Horror, I've also done film work, you know, when the camera's this close and they know if you're lying or not. And that's something that I picked up from her. But no, they never pushed me.
Can you remember your first leading professional role?
My first? Look, I was in the Loft Theatre at NAPAC back in the days when they had resident companies, which was so amazing.
I remember the Loft Theatre well because I come from Durban as well.
Oh, right.
So I remember the Loft Theatre.
Yeah, so I came in just after Nicholas Ellenbogen, I think Murray McGibbon took over.
Mm-hmm.
And it was such brilliant training because, you know, you were rehearsing a show by day and then performing a different show at night, and you were working in different genres, and sometimes you were the lead and sometimes you were a chorus.
Perfect,
and so it
perfect.
Really was about learning how to serve the story.
Mm-hmm.
But I do know that John Moss, I think, cast me as Cinderella in his pantomime at NAPAC. And it was like massive. We had a real pony pulling a crystal. And I think that was when I realized, you know what, playing the ingenue is actually quite boring. I want the characters with the laugh lines and the funny costumes and the, yeah.
Well, that got you into it, let's put it that way. But then this other, you know, as you said just now, you're a storyteller, which you picked up from your mother, and you've written a number of books apart from anything else. Is that something you find enjoyable?
I love it.
Challenging.
Yeah, I love writing. And I have a specific memory of my mom helping me write a creative essay for school, and something just sparked in me there. So that is a big passion of mine, to write. And yeah, I've written a couple of memoirs. I've written a kid's book.
And famously, you wrote a book about healing. I think a lot of people know you through that book. After having had some sort of catastrophe, a book about healing and getting on with your life.
Yeah, so I had a very public divorce quite a while ago. And I wrote a book. I think everyone thought it was going to be sort of like a tell-all. But actually, it was a book about me trying to heal.
Mm-hmm.
And I think...
Cathartic for you.
Yes, it was so weird because, not to sound indulgent, but as I healed, I wrote it. And as I wrote it, I healed. I think writing, for some people, is an incredibly therapeutic tool.
Mm-hmm.
I actually studied logotherapy. I don't know if you know
I don't.
Viktor Frankl, finding meaning in one's story or purpose or lesson or something. And I think that's what writing did for me. And what was so beautiful is the book did do well. I mean, it was a South African bestseller by South African standards. It's sold, I think, 35,000 copies.
What was it called?
It was called Bittersweet.
Bittersweet.
Confessions of a Freshly Single.
Oh, yes, yes, yes.
It was also translated into Afrikaans. And I think initially maybe people bought it because, you know, they wanted to see if there was scandal. But I got so much beautiful feedback from people saying that the book really helped them feel not so isolated. And it wasn't necessarily people going through divorce or separation or betrayal. It was also people who thought their life was going to be a certain way and then had the rug pulled out from underneath them. Mm-hmm. And it's how you cope with change, transition, heartache, and then rediscover yourself and the process that you take for
healing. No wonder it did well. And I think it's interesting as well, and very much to your credit, that you never mentioned the name of your ex-husband. It never came into the book, because the book was about healing,
yeah,
not looking back.
Yeah, I think for a few reasons. The one is that I didn't want it to be about that. I didn't want it to be a tell-all. I also have children. I didn't want them to ever think I was like ragging on their dad.
Yeah,
Also because of my mom and her storytelling wisdom, I wanted it to try and be universal and not make it about me, but just say, this is my story and I think it can hopefully resonate with a lot of people.
But what lovely feedback you got by the sounds of things there, Natasha.
Let's
have another piece of music. And I think it's appropriate that we're listening to this at this exact moment.
Which one have you
picked? Beatles.
Ah, yes. Let It Be by the Beatles. I chose that because, you must correct me, but I think it came out in 1970.
I'm sure it did.
Which was the year I was born.
Oh, okay. Thank you. Right, that solves that problem.
I don't do the math. And also, my dad was a huge Beatles fan.
Mm-hmm.
I think people of his age were like into Elvis or Beatles. And yes, my dad loved the Beatles. I think their lyrics also were beautiful. And I mean, Let It Be is just a song, especially in the times of today when we're facing so much.
When you find yourself in times of trouble.
Yeah, yeah.
Mother Mary.
And sometimes surrender, not giving up, but surrender is a really beautiful thing.
When I find myself in times of trouble, Mother Mary comes to me, speaking words of wisdom, let it be. And in my hour of darkness, she is standing right in front of me, speaking words of wisdom, let it be. Let it be, let it be, let it be, let it be. Whisper words of wisdom, let it be. And when the broken-hearted people living in the world agree, there will be an answer, let it be. For though they may be parted, there is still a chance that they will see, there will be an answer, let it be. Let it be. Whisper words of wisdom. on me. Shine until tomorrow, let it be. I wake up to the sound of music. Mother Mary comes to me, speaking words of wisdom. Let it be.
What a song, what a memorable song, Let It Be. The Beatles there, Paul McCartney, John Lennon, and a choice of my guest. I'm talking to Natasha Sutherland, mostly about the Rocky Horror Show, in which she's the narrator. And that show's just coming back to Peter Tureen's Theatre on the Bay. So you must try and get to see it, because I know it'll fill very quickly.
Yeah.
But Natasha, there's so many things you've done. I think a lot of people... Well, certainly when you came into the studio, I recognized you from Kideo. I knew I'd get it wrong. Kideo,
yes.
On television.
Yeah. So it was a children's TV series. Mm-hmm. And actually my first experience working in front of a camera. I'd been doing theater. I came to Joburg. I auditioned for the role of presenting it. And I got it. And it's an iconic children's TV show. I think it's... It has a beautiful place and a legacy in South Africa. And I think I sometimes think people think I might be embarrassed by the fact that of all the stuff I've done, that's the stuff that they remember. You used to speak to a donkey for a living because there was like a puppet called Mr. Chinwag. But I truly feel so privileged that I was part of that show, because mm-hmm. I know that so many people said, you know, I would come home from school and my mom and dad would be working, and I knew I would switch the TV on and you would be there, and I felt like I always had a friend.
Oh, that's what a lovely story.
So, yeah, I really feel very privileged to be have been part of that of a generation's childhood.
But you also, another iconic thing was Egoli, that you were in that famous television series which ran for so long.
Yeah, no, Egoli was the first soap, that South Africa ever did.
Yes, it was.
Franz Marx, Goli. And I didn't start off, you know, I wasn't at the beginning. My character sort of came in. But that was also a wonderful training ground to be working on a soap and with such icons, and Shailene Suchi Richards, yes, and Christine Besson and Romulda von Rensburg. And yeah, it was amazing.
But you've done so much. Honeytown, Tarzan, The Epic Adventures,
yes.
Operation Delta.
What?
don't do that. And then
these.
There's the Revlon girl.
Yes.
Tell me about the Revlon girl.
Do you know about the Revlon girl?
No.
Oh, you don't know anything about that beautiful...
I've heard about it.
Yeah.
I've heard people talk of the Revlon girl.
Yeah, a beautiful piece based on the tragedy that happened in the Aberfan, the mining disaster in Wales.
Oh, yes.
A beautiful piece written that Stephen Feinstein directed. And I got to work with like Julianne McDowell Hegarty and Heidi Mullens, Michelle Douglas. So it was really very strong all female cast.
Mm-hmm.
Not an easy piece, as I'm sure you can imagine, but still such beautiful elements of humor that
And with
came
that
into
story
it.
As well, that terribly tragic story.
Yeah.
Goodness me.
Yeah.
And you were even an editor of a magazine, Finesse.
I was an editor. I was had a column.
Oh, okay.
I used to write. I was an editor. I was like, whoa, an editor, wow.
Yes.
I used to have a monthly column that I used to contribute, and that was nice. That's hooking into the fact that I loved writing.
Yes, I'm just saying, clearly writing was so very important to you.
Yeah, I do love writing.
So do you enjoy camera work? Do you enjoy television and film? Or is theatre still your main love?
I love both mediums. Both. Oh, and it's good. So funny because a lot of people say you should choose. And I find there have been times where I've been doing film work and theater, and I find in a weird way that they both help me as an actor, working in both mediums. They sort of cross-pollinate.
Oh, that's interesting.
Theater sometimes helps me break out of myself.
Yes.
You know, you have to sort of break yourself open. And film always helps me to find a baseline and a truth and a through line with character and story. So I'm fascinated by all storytelling mediums. I am curious to learn anything and everything.
Goodness me. Mm. And so with something like these, you've written a number of books. I know Bittersweet was a huge success for you. But are the others, they're sort of novels, aren't they, mostly?
No. I'm one of those people who have got a lot of novels on my computer.
Okay, but not on paper yet.
I wrote a little children's book about kids and divorce. Just to sort of try and help kids through divorce, but also maybe to, for parents to look at that. And then the other one was another sort of, it was a kind of a memoir that I also wrote. And I used to do some motivational speaking when my first book came out. I was asked to do quite a lot. I hate saying motivational because it makes it sound like I've got it all figured out, which I certainly don't. But I think it's just,
it's funny that when you do hear, she's a motivational speaker, you think, here, someone who's sorted life's problems out.
Oh, my gosh, no.
And you know that they're not.
No.
Very often, am I right in saying, very often a motivational speaker is working through their own dramas and dilemmas and using this almost as a kind of therapy.
I always think, and once again, going back to my mom as a storyteller, that we all know these truths and we all know these things, but sometimes our egos are on a high alert and we don't want to. And telling a story, like telling a parable almost, is a way of speaking to a person and reaching them, but I say via back door. Because you're telling them a story and then they're learning something, but they're not taking it personally. So they're not putting up a shield or armor or guard. And on some sort of unconscious level, they've absorbed a purpose or a meaning that maybe at a time they'd forgotten, they just needed to resonate with or be reminded of. So yeah, when I say motivational speaker, I'm really not. It's just maybe that's what I used to do. I used to tell them stories about me and whatever they saw in that of themselves. If it helped, then fantastic.
Let's relax with another piece of music. Natasha, what's next on your list?
Ooh, what have I got? Oh, we're certainly going to relax Happy by Pharrell Williams.
Oh, yes.
Do you know it?
Oh, yes, of course. No, I don't.
Well, I chose this because all the pieces I chose are related to moments and people I love, as I'm sure you've figured it out. My younger son, Ben, is one of these wonderful, out-the-box, creative kids that never quite fit into the school system. And when he was little, he used to teach himself how to pop and lock, and he could dance. And I don't know where my dad is a dancer, but he would, he could dance in a way that I can't. And he loved Pharrell Williams, and I took him to see Pharrell Williams' concert when he was in Joburg. And at some stage, bouncers came out and they were asking kids and moms to sign, disclaimers, because he liked to have kids come up on stage when he sang Happy, which is a beautiful song about being happy. And Ben was so excited, and I signed it, and then, the parents had to stand in the front row right close to the stage, and I was waiting for Ben to come out. And Pharrell Williams started singing, and then Ben just started
doing
his
dance.
Little popping and locking, and Pharrell Williams looked at him and went over to him, and the audience went crazy. And it was just one of those moments where, as a mom, my heart was so big, because my son, who battled in a sort of school system that didn't see him, he was just being seen because he was just expressing who he was, because he was happy.
Yeah, gosh, what a wonderful thing for you as a mother to see.
Yeah, it really was.
Okay, let's listen and think of that story.
Clap along if you feel like a room without a roof. Because
happens to you, don't waste your time. Here's why. Because I'm happy.
Clap along if you feel like a room without a roof.
Because I'm happy.
Clap along if you feel like happiness is the truth.
Because I'm happy.
Clap along if you know what happiness is to you.
Because I'm happy.
Clap along if you feel like that's what you want to do.
That song called Happy, Pharrell Williams, and another choice there of my guest, Natasha Sutherland. A good story leading us into that as well. Thanks, Natasha. Now, before you go, because we've not got much time left, I think let's go back to the Rocky Horror Show, which is so much your world at the moment, isn't it? And being so much of your world during the day, how do you get away from it? I mean, you're going to performance this very evening.
Yeah.
Do you go home and have a nap? Do you have a couple of whiskeys?
What are you trying to tell me? I sometimes think my character, I would love to play her, you know, as if she was a bit drunk or getting progressively drunker. Or maybe some people really think she is because she's got this very strange accent. But
it is a strange. I'm glad you brought that up. What accent is that you use? Because it's sort of half posh and half not.
Half not? Oh, dear. Are you saying that I'm slipping? Is this a note? Are you giving me a note?
Not at all. But you speak like that, don't you? Like you've just done now.
Yes. So Stephen said, like I've told you right off the bat, the director said, we want you to play her like a very strict headmistress.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know, you know, reading the script, one of her first monologues, she says it was a night they would remember for a very long time. And I'm a big fan of The Crown, the TV series The Crown. So I don't know, just the Queen and Maggie Thatcher, that whole thing just jumped into my head. And I love it. It's almost like a character chooses what it wants,
yes.
If that makes sense. Proper
yes.
Sounds incredibly, I don't know, indulgent. So I decided to make, so she speaks very, you know, she says things like naught and offered, and it's a very long time. And I just felt it lent itself very much to her kind of trying to be very prim and proper and keep this chaotic
night
in tow.
Because I remember thinking, gosh, she's trying to be all posh here when everyone's gone mad and speaking in those, you know, just, well, no one speaks in accents really, do they? They just all.
Well, I mean, you've got Brad and Janet is set in sort of 1950s America.
That's right.
And right. Then Frank, you know.
He's the alien.
And then you've got Magenta and, they, you know, they're all playing aliens and stuff. So Yeah, and I think it's I think it's lovely when she speaks posh, and then we get heckles from the audience, and she says words like horny, or you know, she says sort of naughty words, but it's very posh. It's probably quite, I don't know.
You were very well behaved the night I was there.
Well, it's probably because you were very well behaved.
The audience was well behaved.
You'll have to be not well behaved when you come
next
back
next time, and see how you deal with it.
Yes,
but it sounds, Natasha, as though you're having great fun. It's an unusual role, I think, for you. Don't you agree? From all the things you've done, being the narrator on the Rocky Horror
Show. It is unusual. And what was so wonderful is that I started the year off doing Manadville Twelfth Night.
That's right. I wanted to ask you, have you done your Shakespeare bit, haven't you?
Yes, it was such a beautiful. I think Manadville is a bucket list. You know, just open air theatre under the trees was just magnificent. And that particular production, also directed by Stephen Stead, was such an amazing, lovely, tight cast. And it had such a beautiful air about it. So I was playing Mariah, who's sort of, you know, she's sort of delicious and slightly wicked. And then going from that into the Rocky Horror, which is just like, you know, light years apart. And then also this very strict set character who's, you know, trying to toe the line. It was a wonderful jump to make as an actress. But there is something that I do, and I think with all my roles, for some reason, especially theatre, is that I do sometimes take on the intonation and the pattern. So like when I did Shirley Valentine, she had to be Scouser and speak sort of Manchester, and you know, and as Natasha, sometimes I start speaking slightly in the lilt, and my sons are so used to it now, they're kind of like, oh, could you please stop with the so-and-so voice, and, oh mom, could you please just drop the narrator voice, I don't even know that I'm doing it. I get like, darlings, and my son will just roll his eyes and go, mom, you're at home now, you can relax
take off those high-heeled shoes.
Yes.
Why did I say that? Anyway, Natasha, we're going to stop there now. But it's been fascinating talking to you about a fascinating role. And you made a good point. I didn't realize it was really difficult. I thought it was an easy role. You just sort of narrated. But as you say, it requires a lot of production, a lot of thought, a lot of preparation.
Well, maybe for other narrators, it's a walk in the park. maybe for me, I'm now admitting stuff, that I shouldn't. But it certainly is a challenging one in that there is a rogue variable every night, and that is the audience.
So if you go and see the Rocky Horror Show, which I hope you do, keep a lookout for Natasha. You won't miss her because she's your link with the lunacy on stage. Natasha, thank you. What's your last piece of music?
Oh, what did I choose? Oh, Atom Bomb Baby by the Five Stars.
Oh, yes.
Yes, so it's old jazz. And my link to this is I love jazz. I can't say that I am... I probably listen to mainstream, which might offend some of very seasoned jazz listeners. And I used to, doing school drop-offs in the morning, I used to listen to jazz and my boys would roll their eyes. And then there was the one time I heard my boys listening to the old jazz music, one of them being Atom Bomb Baby by Five Stars. And I just didn't understand why they were listening to it. And it's because they were playing a game called Fallout, which is set in a bunker after like apocalypse, and they've just got this like set track of 1950s, 40s old jazz coming through. And my boys just thought it was like amazing, but it was just wonderful that they were now listening to it and really loving it. And Atom Bomb Baby happens to be one of the ones, especially my older son, Sebastian. He loved it. So, that's why I thought I'd
add
it.
Here we go. Natasha Sullivan, thank you very much, and best of luck.
Thank you so much. It's been great.
Got a doll, baby, I love her so. Nothing else like her anywhere you go. A man, she's anything but calm. A regular pint-sized atom bomb. Atom bomb, baby, little atom bomb. I want her in my wigwam. She's just the way I want her to be. A million times hotter than TNT. Atom bomb baby, loaded with power, radioactive as a TV tower, a nuclear vision in her soul, loves with the electronic control. Atom bomb baby, little atom bomb, I want her in my wigwam. She's just the way I want her to be, a million times hotter than TNT. Bum. Atom
one of those chain reactions in my heart. A big explosion, big and loud, mushrooms me right up on a cloud.
Atom bomb, baby, little atom bomb. I want her in my wigwam. She's just the way I want her to be. A million times higher than TNT.
Bum,
Pleiada,
bum,
Pleiada,
bum,
Pleiada,
bum,
Pleiada.
Atom bomb, lady, sweet as a plum. Carries more wild than uranium. When she kisses, there's no hitch. 0 hours, she turns on the switch.
Atom bomb, baby, little atom bomb. I want her in my wigwam. She's just the way I want her to be. A million times hotter than TNT. Atom bomb, baby, little atom bomb. I want her in my wigwam. She's just the way I want her to be. A million times hotter than TNT.
People of Note on Fine Music Radio was proudly brought to you by Peter Turin Productions.